I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. 1.5 million. That's the number of people reportedly incarcerated in the United States. Beginning in the 1980s, the nation saw an ever-expanding prison industry designed to manage a steady stream of new felons and recidivists. Now some states are finding they can't afford the billions of tax dollars supporting the prison system. Rethinking the role of rehabilitation may be part of the answer. That's what Jennifer Gonerman says. She's a journalist covering the prison beat, and her latest article kicks off a special edition of Mother Jones magazine that examines the prison system. Jennifer, great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me, Farai.
So this is a whole special issue on the issue of prisons. Your article talks about the economic impact the prison system is having on the nation. So what kind of money are we talking about?
We're talking about a tremendous amount of money that's being spent nationally and by the individual states. At least $55 billion a year is spent on our prison system, on every conceivable aspect of it. And the numbers are absolutely astonishing, as you mentioned.
Times like this, when the economies of states are in default, can states really afford this?
I really don't think they can, and many, many state legislators are starting to agree with that idea and to really rethink their priorities. I mean, every dollar that you spend building and running a prison is a dollar that's not spent on a public university or health care or roads and bridges. And at this point, Kansas, Texas, and at least 11 other states are taking a very serious look at how to try out some new strategies that will curb their prison population, shrink the number of people behind bars so they can save a little money, reduce some recidivism, and have money for other budget priorities.
Well, back up and tell us how we got here, because in your article you say in 1970 our prisons held fewer than 200,000 people. What happened?
A number of things happened, but primarily it's what's called our nation's war on drugs. And I say so-called war on drugs because, you know, we like to use that metaphor all the time on everything. But essentially, a new host of sentencing practices took hold in the early 70s and spread across the country, mandatory minimum sentences, meaning that the amount of drugs involved in a particular crime would affect the severity of the punishment. So even if you were a low-level drug mule, for example, the amount of drugs you were carrying was going to ensure that you get a very large sentence, perhaps even more than a drug kingpin if that person was caught without a lot of drugs. At any rate, this trend started in New York in 1973 and by the end, virtually every state in the country and the federal government had its own version of these drug laws. And ultimately, that's what's helped to be the engine that has led to this sort of prison industrial complex we have today.
We spoke not too long ago with someone from the Corrections Corporation of America, which runs privately operated prisons. How influential are they in terms of shaping prison policy in America?
I think it varies completely state by state. We don't have private prisons here in New York State, but down in Texas, private prisons contain maybe 10 or 11% of all the inmates, and that number, I think, is growing. They're pumping a tremendous amount of money into lobbying state legislators to approve more and more private prisons, and as we lock more and more people up, they often make the argument that somehow private prisons will save money. And I don't think that argument has really been borne out, but it's certainly the argument that's been used to get approval in a number of different states to build more and more private prisons.
You followed a woman who'd been in prison for 16 years and the life of her family and how that family life really crumbled. But once someone gets into prison with a felony, say 10 years or more sentence, what, if anything, happens to try to make sure that person can lead a good life and a non-criminal life once they get out?
Well, this varies state to state and prison to prison, but on the whole, not very much happens. I mean, there was a time in the 70s or so when we really thought about prisons as a place where rehabilitation was supposed to take place. You know, signs were tacked up outside prisons across the country calling them correctional facilities. But today that mission has been all but abandoned, and there really is no pretense that anything other than pure punishment is going on behind bars. And there's perhaps no better indicator of this than the fact that in the mid-90s, Congress eliminated Pell Grants for prisoners, a move that effectively abolished almost all of the 350 prison college programs across the country, even though study after study has shown that if you educate an inmate, he or she is far less likely to return to prison after their release.
Let's talk just briefly about how the incarceration of the woman you followed for your book affected her family. What kinds of things are we talking about?
Sure. She was locked up for 16 years. in a maximum security prison in New York State, and the toll on the family is almost hard to even wrap your mind around. I mean, obviously, there's a tremendous financial impact when you take a breadwinner out of the house. When she was locked up, she had four small children, so somebody had to care for her children. And in her case, she was lucky enough to have a mother who was willing to take them in. But that, of course, is a tremendous burden on an older person, and her mother ended up dying prematurely. And ultimately, her very lengthy incarceration all but decimated the family, straining every possible relationship. And so by the time she was released, all of her kids were adults. In some ways, they were strangers to her, even though they had visited her over the years. And one of her sons was actually locked up the same day that was locked up at the time that she was released from prison.
So where do we go from here as a nation? I mean, there are plenty of other publications and broadcast outlets that talk about this. And there is a huge amount of controversy and different approaches. Some people saying, well, look, if you committed a crime, tough on you. But where is the conversation, you think, going to go from here?
I think with all of this education in the media, we're starting to have a more nuanced discussion that moves beyond the sentiment you just described about tough on you if you commit a crime, and starting to really think about what is a crime, what is defined as a crime, how is one criminal different from another, who's violent, who's not violent, where do we really want to be spending our money, and on whom do we want to be spending that money, and what kind of results do we want? I mean, it's not good enough, I think, just to have so many people behind bars. In fact, it's sort of the embarrassment and the shame of America, particularly when, and there may be no better example of how broken our system is, the fact that about half of those people will be back in prison within 3 years convicted of a new crime.
Why do you think that is? Can you go into one specific example for us, Kansas, which has started to do some rethinking of how it treats criminal justice?
Kansas is in some ways leading the way here in trying out new strategies to curb their prison costs, particularly in the area of parole, and really redefining what parole is supposed to be doing. I mean, years ago, parole officers were thought of as social workers, people who would help an ex-inmate make that transition into the world. And somewhere along the line in the last 20 years or so, just as our prison system's mission has changed, so has parole, so that parole officers, for the most part, have come to think of themselves almost like police officers, where their job is just to watch somebody and lock them up at the first hint of trouble. Now, obviously, not all parole officers think of their job that way, but on the whole, agencies have started to move in that direction. And what Kansas has done is to try to turn things around once again so that not every parolee who runs afoul of an administrative rule is immediately shipped back to prison, but instead is given another chance. And actually, the parole officer will work with them to try to keep them out of prison as opposed to just trying to lock the cuffs on them as fast as possible.
Well, Jennifer, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Farai.
Jennifer Gonerman is the author of Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett. She wrote the article Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration. It's the lead article in a special edition of Mother Jones Magazine examining America's prison system. And she joined us from her NPR studios in New York.